one of our own on WNR.
The sound of Waterford. WLOR. WLOR.
In this seventh programme from the second series of One of Our Own, Andrew Doherty is interviewed by Catherine Foley about his life and passion for the maritime history of his native place of Cheek Point. Roseanne Foley recorded and edited the series, which is produced by Uncorsacock.
This was made with funding from Commissioned Na Man and the television license fee.
Andrew Doherty, fisherman, blogger, historian, tour guide and environmentalist, started out by telling me about his parents.
Now, my mother married my father at Christmas of, I think it was 64, and I was born in 65, November 65. She'd been over in London for, I'd say nearly, well, about 6, 7, 8 years or something like that. My father was away for 20-something years. He was sailing from Liverpool with coastlines.
And where did they come home to live?
They came home to Cheek Point. And my mother was pregnant with me. She thought she'd have nothing to do but go into the infirmary in Waterford, in John's Hill, to give birth to me. Went in labour with my aunt and rocked up to the door, and the matron said, "You're not on our books," and she wouldn't see her and wouldn't let her in the door. So it ended up, somehow or other, they ended up, after many different twists and turns, they ended up out in Arkeen. And apparently I was born out in Arkeen, but the rest of the lads were all born in Airmount in Waterford.
Gosh.
My mother,
some
the stress
there.
For my mother. Was, yeah, absolutely. Imagine that.
This was in the mid-60s, wasn't it?
65. Yeah. So they'd met, they were both from Cheek Point. They both emigrated. My father went in the early 50s. My mother went actually on one of the last of the Great Western trips across from Waterford to Fishguard. She emigrated on that. He was in Liverpool, as I said, working out there on the ships for coastline shipping, a seafarer. So he and my mother then, they met in London, came home and decided they were going to stay in Cheek Point and raise a family. So I was the firstborn, and there was six followed me. And my father got a job with the building of Great Island Power Station, which was built, Great Island in County Wexford, which is directly across the river at Great Island, just further up from Ballyhack. Yeah. And so that power station was built for, I think it was between 65 and 68. So my father worked there. But he was also going to sea at different times as well in that time.
Andrew had what sounds like an idyllic childhood, growing up in the area of Cheek Point at the confluence of the three rivers. And Andrew, were you a bit like Huckleberry Finn? That's the image I have of you, growing up on the banks of the river. Was the shore your Mississippi?
It was, yeah, because it was the only place to go. There was nothing in Cheek Point.
And I so was that, you used to go to Passage East, where my mother was from.
Sure.
Is it, that was like your capital.
With Ronder, with Gallivant. You know, that was the phrase that my mother would say, "Where are you off Gallivanting to?" But we'd be expected to go away for the day. Do you know what I mean? They'd make nothing of it once you were home for the dinner or whatever else like that. Mm-hmm. And we would. We'd go up over the Manon. We'd go over the Hurtle down to Passage. We'd get the boats and we'd cross over to Snow Hill, which is in Kilkenny, go up onto the railway line, we'd put haypennies down on the railway tracks, we'd walk the railway line across the Barrow Bridge, which weren't of course supposed to do, we'd go to Great Island in Wexford, we'd go up the Campoyle Pill, and we'd wander all over the place. But primarily it was the Strand for me, and I think the draw of the Strand was my grandmother used to love being down on the Strand.
This was Cheek Point.
Cheek Point, the Strand in Cheek Point, and it runs between Cheek Point and Passage. And it stops about, I'd say, about 3/4 of a mile above Passage. It becomes more of a cliff and you can't walk. But you can walk about 1.5 miles, and my grandmother used to be down there the whole time. She was foraging timber and... Do you know what I mean? And her neighbours would be there and she'd meet him and all this kind of stuff. But I used to love been in her company, and I'd always be getting the stories from her and everything else like that. So,
was this your father's mother now, or your mother's?
My mother's mother?
Really?
Yeah, Maura Moran was her name.
What?
Maura Moran.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she was the youngest of seven. And there are. She was born in the house where I now live with my wife Dina and our three children. So there was a great. Her parents were both fishing stock. Her mother's people, the Malones, they lived there, and the Mourns then married into there.
Andrew told me then about his school days, recalling how he didn't particularly like being in a classroom.
Faith Lake National School, yeah. My mother and father went there as well. My grandmother went there as well. Different schools, but still Faith Lake National School. Yeah. I didn't like school. It was a small class, and there was only a handful of us in it. And we had Raoul and Joanne Smith. They were the most exotic. Their parents were artists, Charlie and Joan, and they emigrated to Australia since. And they're internationally renowned sculptors and artists. So the two lads were kind of, they were very much, you know, out on a, they were very different to the rest of us. There was Brendan Foley from the village. There was William Doherty. And Gerard Doherty, his first cousin, we're distantly related, but the two lads were first cousins. There was William Elliott from the village. His dad was a bus driver. And there was Michael Duffin in the class, whose dad was a river pilot. And then Brendan Doherty was the last. And again, he's a distant relation of mine as well. But
so that was apart from the one exotic girl.
Apart from Joanne, yeah, who's now a computer whiz down under in Australia. Yeah, I wasn't bookish, and I didn't like school, and I was never comfortable in school. And although I passed the leaving cert, I passed the junior cert first. Well, it was the inter in those days. And then I passed the leaving. It was an absolute shock to me because I exceeded everyone's expectations, I think.
Where did you go to secondary school then?
I went to the De La Salle. Most boys from Cheap Point went to the De La Salle for two reasons. Firstly, it's the first school. When the school bus would drive you into Waterford, it's the first school on the road in. Obviously, we wouldn't go to Newtown because that would be too highbrow for us. But the second reason was that the De La Salle had a junior novitiate in Faith Lake, in the grounds where Faith Lake House Hotel now is. That was a junior seminary, or a junior novitiate, I think was the phrase they used. So young boys who were thinking of becoming Christian Brothers came there from the age of 12, and they lived the life of a Christian Brother, and they went in on their own bus into the De La Salle and went to school there, and then came back to Faith Lake House, and that was their room and board, basically.
Once Andrew had finished second level in 1983, he turned to fishing. He was 18 years of age.
And you have to remember, in places like Passage and Cheap Point, young lads went out in the boats for their summer holidays, and you fished.
And you had done that?
I'd done that from about 7 or 8. And from about the age of 13, once you went to secondary school, you kind of sat into the boat for the whole of the summer. So you were the boy in the boat.
And what would they be fishing for then, Andrew? Was it salmon? Was it seasonal?
It was salmon fishing during the summertime. So the salmon drift netting was what we practiced in Cheap Point and Passage. Yeah. But you were the boy in the boat, but basically you were given a third share of whatever was caught. So you had a great old jingle in your pocket going around.
You were learning. It felt good. You were good. Earning money.
You were, yeah. So you were able to. I remember one of the lads, Black Arden, you know, he smoked, and he said he went into town in September, into the school, and went off and bought 10 fags, and fellas nearly dropped dead at the sight of them coming out with 10 fags. They were going in, and if they were lucky, they'd be able to buy one between a couple of them. But it was because we were earning money when we were out fishing on the river, you know. So that was the attraction.
That would have been the turn of the 80s, was it? So were the salmon scarce, or were they plentiful?
They came in different runs, I suppose. I always remember at home, they said the 50s were the blackest times in Cheap Point, because the salmon basically disappeared and everyone basically emigrated. But in the 60s, they came back and they were strong for a number of years after. So the 70s were very strong, and the 80s were very good as well. But by the 90s, things were really taking a turn for the worse. Now, I'd started fishing full time in 83. So I kind of lived through that deterioration. And everyone at home had their own theories about it, you know, about, oh, they'll come back and things will improve. But I could see for myself, I suppose I would be very reflective, and I'd listen to the older people and I'd have great time and great store in what they'd be saying. And they were saying, well, look, those lads, they're fishing miles and miles of nets out on the high seas. And ye lads, now you're getting bigger nets, you're getting deeper nets, you're fishing these plastic nets, this monofilament netting and gut netting and this kind of stuff. And I said, these fish can't last, you know. But sure, I was of an age where my only interest is, you know, catch as much fish and have as much money as I possibly can at the end of the week.
So you got your own boat, did you?
Yeah, but it would have been...
What kind of a boat was
a
it?
A small punt, and it was 18
it was enough,
foot.
Was it?
18-foot punt, and it's perfect for the
and
conditions.
And an outboard engine, was it?
An outboard engine. You'd also have two paddles for you know, two oars for making your way around as well.
And how far out of the estuary would you go?
We didn't go far at all, you see, and this is the thing. At Cheek Point, we had our own kind of area to fish in. Mm-hmm. So we'd fish from Cheek Point Village down as far as Passage, or maybe down as far as the Spitlight or the Church Point. And below that, we tended not to go. Some of the older lads did. Yeah. And traditionally, in the old days when they used the oars, they would drift. So if you set your nets on the ebb tide, for example, so you have the ebb tide and you have the flood tide. And our whole way of life was governed by the tides. Yeah. But if you set your nets at Cheek Point on the ebb tide, you drift them to the castle. Castle is Buttermilk Castle, which is above Ballyhack on the Wexford side.
Oh, right, okay.
So we'd drift as far as there, you'd set the nets off again and you'd drift them down again towards the Spitlight. And depending on how they were looking, you might haul them in again and set them off again and drift them down towards Duncannon. That's what they did in the old days. And then when the tide had come low and then it started to come back in, they drift them back up to Cheek Point. But that was how their day was spent, drifting
so
with the tide.
Were you fishing on your own or did you have somebody with you?
I had somebody with me most of the time anyway. Yeah. But what happened was when outboard motors came in, it made it a lot easier to get around the river. Mm. And you didn't have to be as, I suppose, driven by the tides. You could kind of bend the tides to your will to a certain extent. Mm. And one man in a boat became more popular. I suppose in the 90s, as the nets got better, the leads disappeared off of the lead ropes and lead line came in, which didn't foul as easily. Things became a lot easier for one man to work in the boat. Outboard engines became more reliable. So it was possible to do, but it's a lonely old place to be because, I mean, if you fish the whole tides, I mean, an ebb tide would be 6 hours. And then if you fished a bit of the flood, so you could be 8, 10, 12 hours out there without really seeing people. So it's a long old time to go without having somebody to chat to.
And where were you moored? Where would you moor?
Well, at Cheek Point, there's the quay, the main quay and the lower quay. But in those days, all the people had their own kind of favourite spots. There was the Rookery, which was up the river. There was Mourne's Poles, which is down below my grandmother's. It's named for my grandmother's people. And that was just a mud patch down on the strand. Yeah. And you'd trip off the boat there and it should be perfectly fine. But other people then, all the quays down along, all the way down to Passage, they all had family names. So you had Mourne's Poles, Ryan's Quay, Sullivan's Quay, Sean's Slip, Barn Quay, Powers Quay.
What about the Blind Quay? I often wondered about that in Passage. Is that a family name, the Blind Quay?
Yeah, well, it's B-L-Y-N-D, so that's...
So it could be.
It sounds family-orientated, but I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, I often wondered. I interviewed a fellow a long time ago, a fisherman from Ballinagowl, from here in Ring, and he said fishing, it's like a game with God, that you're constantly, you know, you're out there by yourself and you're wondering, will you, won't you, and you're kind of... Did you were saying about being a solitary and a thinker, and was it like that? Is it quite spiritual?
I wouldn't have said so at the time, as reflective as I might have been. I appreciated that, but I didn't really put a value on it.
The nature and all that all around you.
I did appreciate on a level, but you were always this hungriness about, you know, will I catch a fish and where do I go to catch a fish and why aren't I catching fish? And then you catch fish and you're absolutely elated, you know. So you have all of that. But I think when the salmon fishery closed in 2006, it was basically, it's been outlawed and we haven't been able to fish since.
And so, how long did you spend fishing, Andrew?
So from 83 up to about the late 90s, and even in 2006 I was still fishing part-time.
But you said you went up along, you were fishing out of Helvik, so you must have gone beyond then the estuary. How did that happen?
But that was for different species of fish. So when I was in Helvik, I was fishing herring, and we had the nets moored. So they were drift nets again, but they were moored out in the bay here with anchors, and we'd come back then and haul them in. And I only did that occasionally with I was relief crew on one of the boats. Yeah. But we would have fished eels at Cheek Point. We would have fished herring at Dunmore East. We'd have done ground nets out off the coast down as far as Tramore Bay, fished lobster as relief for my father. My father was fishing at that point with a fella called Robert Ferguson, who's still there to the good, thank God. Fishing lobster. And I remember being out with Robert and we were 20 miles out off of Hookhead, for example. Do you know what I mean? So that's the thing about fishing, I suppose. You go after whatever is there to be gone after.
Andrew was still a teenager when he met his wife and his life partner, Dina Bible.
Dina was a blow-in to the community, you know. She moved out. Her granddad and her grandmother lived in Cheek Point. They had a holiday home there. They had a shop in Waterford up in Keynes Road.
Yeah. And what sort of a shop?
Just a corner store.
Oh, yeah.
But
okay.
It had all, and Dina worked in it. And her mother worked in it. When she was still in school. And
is that where you met her?
No, they bought a holiday home out in Cheek Point, Doherty's at the Green, as it turned out. And the family used to come out during the summertime. So I met Dina first down on the Green, where we would gather. We'd be swimming. She was a brilliant swimmer, still is. We'd be playing games like rounders and soccer.
So you were quite young then?
Very, like we were teenagers, yeah. When she first came. But then they actually moved to Cheek Point and they built a house in Faithlick. Her own dad and mother, they moved to Faithlick. And Dina, obviously the family came with them. But herself and her brother played in a band called True Blue. Her brother is Dylan Bible. He's quite a talented jazz musician. And he teaches in SETU in the music department in there. But they had a band called True Blue. And although I knew Dina for a long time, they were playing a gig in Jack Mead's one time. And we were fishing and we came down after fishing and we had a few drinks and I spotted Dina and we started chatting and it all kind of...
It blossomed from
yes.
there.
Andrew's first child was born in 1996. Just when various EU and government policies and restrictions were starting to impact on local fishing livelihoods. It was then that he started to look seriously at alternative ways to make a living.
And as a fisherman, were you worried about, you know, earning a living and providing for
absolutely.
Them? Was that a constant pressure on you?
When Joel came in 96, that was...
He was first, was he, did you say? Yeah.
I remember being out in the boat thinking to myself, like, this isn't working. Do you know, and I remember the moment quite well because it was dark. It was a beautiful... I don't know if it was frosty, but it was dark. One of these crystal clear nights and the stars were literally glittering out of the sky and the moon was coming up over on the Wexford side and I was drift netting. I was somewhere between Cheek Point and Passage and I remember the moon coming up and I remember thinking, God, life is brilliant. Yeah. But then I was thinking to myself, but I have a young child at home.
Baby,
and,
little baby boy.
Yeah, and like, you know, my father had been at sea. He'd worked in factories. He'd been fishing. But he'd also had to depend on social welfare a lot at the time. And I was thinking to myself, well, you know, this is where I'm going to be going unless I can find some way out of, you know, making the fishing work for me.
And so Andrew got involved in further education. Soon he was signed up and studying community development. As part of his work, he wrote a dissertation on the closure of salmon and eel fishing. He looked at the effect this was having on his own community. It was then that his personal mission to preserve the heritage of this way of life began in earnest.
Through the women's group in Cheap Point, actually, in Faithlick, they started, they had initiated a course through FOSS looking at community enterprise. And basically, I went along to the training and I was really intrigued by this whole notion of how do you add value into a community to retain people's roles within it, and looking at what the glue that holds a community together and how important it was, like seeing fishermen coming in and going out. And I remember when I did my dissertation in WIT, I did it on, you know, the role of salmon fishing in the community. And when I was interviewing people, they were talking about how important it was to see boats coming in and the lads coming up the quay and to hear the boots even in the road passing up, and how reassuring it was. And the fact that, well, an elderly...
And did you feel it another way that this was disappearing, this livelihood, this way of life?
Absolutely. And that was the whole point, I suppose, behind the dissertation. It was analysing that and looking at what was happening.
Andrew's blog started in response to a need to record the heritage he was born into. In October 2017, he published his first book, Before the Tide Went Out. His second book, Waterford Harbour Tides and Tales, was published in September 2020 by the History Press. His third book, The Prong Curious Craft of the Three Sister Rivers, will soon be published.
So where did your blog start? How did that come about? When did that start?
When I was in WIT, I had to do a reflective journal. And I realised that I actually...
You loved it.
I loved the reflective journal. I always liked writing, but I could never really find something that I actually felt that I was any good at. But I enjoyed reading my reflective journals. And even if I read back at it a month or 2 months or even a year later, I thought to myself, God, that's really interesting. That's worth retaining on some level. So that's what started me blogging, because I thought to myself, well, here I am writing stuff in notebooks that is never going to... That I could lose, that could be burnt, or, you know, but I could write this on this blog. At some stage in around 2014, I started writing a blog, and it was just a hobby, and it was just a place of putting down some thoughts. But very quickly, it sort of morphed into something a lot more. And it kind of, I remember I wrote a blog, and it was about, I think the first one, I have this vision that it was about my grandmother and, you know, stuff that my grandmother used to tell me. And I remember I wrote it, I published it, and I put it on Facebook saying, here's a story I'm after writing. And I literally cowered for the day. I was terrified to look, because I was certain people were going to absolutely laugh at me, ridicule me, say all the things that I'd done wrong. But it was the complete opposite. People were saying, isn't that lovely, and doesn't that make sense, and wasn't your grandmother a wise woman, and all of this kind of stuff. Yeah. So because of the positive feedback, I suppose, I'm over 400 stories now on the blog. The book came out in 2017, and primarily because my mother was saying, all these women are telling me about stories you're writing and I can't see any of them. So
there you gave her a book. Were you nervous about publishing yourself?
Oh, if I was nervous. The blog kind of gave me reassurance that people were interested in what I was saying.
Yeah.
Now, I wrote this, the book, it's called Before the Tide Went Out.
Yeah, it's a great title, Andrew.
And a friend named Damien McClellan suggested that title to me, because he loved this idea of what the village was like as a fishing village.
Yeah.
So that's what the stories were about. And we got I think it was 400 books. We had Jack Meads booked for the launch. Damien Tiernan was going to do the launch. And brought the books back to Cheek Pint. And we went down to the launch. And literally, there was a deluge of rain. The road looked like the river heading down to Jack Meads. And I remember thinking, I was gutted because I said, well, Jesus, at least if the weather was nice, there might be a few people that come down. Well, you couldn't swing a cat, go Jack away. Meads. And poor Dina was left to sell the books.
Did you sell the first that night?
We covered the cost of the printing that first night. I think we sold nearly 200.
After a number of years together, Andrew and Dina decided to make it official and get married.
We got married between Hannah and Ellen. And so I remember carrying Hannah for the wedding. We got married in the back garden and we got a marquee actually from...
So you're a hippie at heart, Andrew, are you?
Well, I'm not. I think it's Dina who's the hippie. It's not me. I'm very straight-laced. But Dina was adamant that she didn't want anything to do with a church wedding or anything else like that. So we got married in a registry office in town. But
what year was that?
That was 2001.
Talking about getting married and that, I just want a final question about do you have faith or your relationship with God, or do you believe in a God?
I do. On some level anyway, but I would find it, I suppose, in the environment or down by the river or out on the water or looking at nature. That's where I definitely would feel it. But I do like going into churches, and I do like, you know, sitting in church. I like the quietness of a church. I don't like the razzmatazz. My mother would sit there with the rosary beads looking at the mass, and do you know what I mean? And that'd be her thing. I'd love to go in and sit. I love the smell of incense, and I like the candles burning, and I like going to the graveyard. I like going visiting my grandmother, visiting my father, visiting my brother and my sister, and you know, and remembering the people of the village as well. It's important to me, but you know, so that's how I'd connect with it, I suppose.
Listen, thanks, Andrew. It was lovely to talk to you. Gur míle maith.
Thanks, Catherine.
This was made with funding from Cumasúna Man and the television license fee.